Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we speak with Alan Menken. We also discuss the International Thespian Festival, Unlocked. Zach Braff is coming to Broadway and Bullets Over Broadway, and some other news. So please stay tuned.
Little town, it's a quiet village. Every day, like the one before. Little town, full of little people. Tray like always, the same old bread and rolls to sell. Every morning just the same, since the morning that we came to this poor provincial town.
Good morning, ma'am.
Oh, good morning, monsieur.
And where are you off?
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, June 30th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Also with us this morning, we have Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk on Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He's also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many other places around the internet. Alan Menken is with us this morning. Alan is an Academy Award winner, a Grammy Award winner, a Tony Award winner. His movies have included The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Pocahontas, and a handful of those have transferred to Broadway, as you know. We also have Little Shop of Horrors, Weird Romance, Christmas Carol, King David, Sister Act, Leap of Faith, Newsies. Alan is a mainstay on Broadway, and we're very happy to have him here this morning. So, Alan, thank you for joining us this morning, getting up on a Sunday morning. Tell us about The Neighbors and what's going on with that.
Well, it's already gone on.
Yes.
The Neighbors was a show created by Dan Fogelman, and Dan was our book writer on Tangled. And it was really unusual working with him on Tangled because he'd never done a musical before. But he's such a strong, creative, you know, force as a writer and as a comedy writer, and really smart. And so we had a lot of fun, sort of reinventing the process and somehow coming up with something that worked on Tangled. And I wasn't sure after that if you know, perhaps Dan would go, "That was great. I never want to see Alan Menken and Glenn Slater again in my life." Because it was rough and tumble, you know. Musicals are not for sissies.
Yeah.
Well, anyway. And then I get a call earlier this year, actually it was last year, it was in the fall. Dan was interested in doing a musical episode of The Neighbors, and would I be interested in working on it? And my instant reaction was yes, but let's first take a look at it. So I took a look at the series, and I love the series. It is kind of very. There are similarities between it and Third Rock and Big Bang and a lot of other series with these kind of fish out of water, but I just found the characters delightful and the idea that these, I don't know if people know the premise, but basically this normal family moves into a condominium community where everybody else is very strange, and so they find out that this is basically a group of aliens have taken over this particular condo, and they're very friendly aliens, although clueless about our planet, and they're going to learn about it, and in this episode they learn about Broadway musicals. It was a blast working on it, and everybody was great as far as, you know, the back and forth. The first idea I had was after they come back from seeing the show, they should sing something like Belle about, you know, we want to see all the wonderful things in this world that we, you know, haven't experienced before, you know. And of course, there are all these completely anachronistic, crazy things that one wouldn't think of as being particularly a highlight of our planet. But to these aliens, it's like, yes, let's hitchhike to L.A. Let's go to a dive bar.
Well, I think the three, Peter, Michael, and myself would say that, you know, musicals are the highlight of our planet.
Well, yeah.
And especially the stuff that you created.
Well, yeah, but in the song, they're making reference to all the other things they want to experience. Yeah.
Well, that fish out of water thing, of course, it's a tried and true trope in theater and TV and film. Hasn't someone been working on a musical of the Munsters?
Really? The Munsters?
Oh, I haven't heard that.
Peter? Peter, is that
some? Yes, I have heard that too. But of course,
we had the Addams Family. Yeah.
Sure. Alan, one question I've always wanted to ask you, and that involves your lyric writing. I remember decades ago hearing a marvelous song for which you wrote the lyrics called Pink Fish and Stale Donuts. Now, I imagine many of our listeners don't know it, but nevertheless, this was a song in which a man from Texas comes to New York and he discovers the people are eating pink fish on stale donuts. And what he means, of course, is bagels and lox.
Right. And, so, and what he really means is, oh, there's Jews here.
So I thought it was a tremendous song in terms of lyrics. And I've often wondered why you haven't continued to write.
Well,
lyrics.
Actually, I'm back to writing lyrics. But this is going to be a slightly frustrating conversation because I'm finally, after 23 years, on a musical where I am writing the lyrics, and I can't talk about what it is.
Yeah, we understand that.
Because it's brand new, but I'm actually really excited to be coming back to writing lyrics. I stopped writing lyrics. First of all, when I started working with Howard Ashman, it was so clear that Howard's vision in terms of what he wanted to do was completely tied to him writing the lyrics, and. You know, he was so brilliant. I gladly stepped aside. And, you know, the compensation for me in that relationship was I gained scoring, you know, underscoring movies. And I really gained the ability to work on so many, you know, projects simultaneously. So while I was working with Howard, I was also working with the late Tom Ion, and I was working with a man named Steve Brown. We had a show with Michael Bennett. And so I began juggling lots of projects, even in my pre-Disney days, with lots of lyricists. And then, after Howard passed away, I was actually the first person to step in to write the lyrics for Aladdin, and I wrote a song, which actually was very good, I think, called You Can Count on Me. It wasn't quite the right spot. Would I write another? Sure, no problem, except I'm in the middle of scoring Beauty at the same time and doing Newsies at the same time. So basically what happened was lyric writing takes time. That's all there is to it. It's, you know, I could sketch out a piece of music and then say I'll arrange it later. But with a lyric, you really can't arrange it later. You've got to really got to come up with exactly what you want, get it in there, and get it right. And so Tim Rice stepped in, and there's the compensation of working with a totally different personality and a totally different kind of lyricist and writing really the kind of song Howard and I never would have written. Or working with Jack Feldman on Newsies, and then with Stephen Schwartz, you know, and then David Zippel, and it just sort of went on from there. And there was never an instance where I felt I'm the lyricist for this particular show. With Glenn, there was such an intelligence to the way he picked up the homages that we did in Sister Act. So I love my lyricists. I love sitting in the room with them. I love bouncing off them. And finally, a project that, you know, has come along that I'm doing now. And actually, the book writer is very actively involved and is in the room with me, and it's very style driven, and we're having a great time. And so, you know, there's one that's come along that I'm going to do, and I hope I don't, you know, get my head handed to me when it shows up on stage. But, but it's fun to be getting back to that. And I still have some, you know, I'm very committed to all my collaborations. That's the other thing is I'm a social guy. I love my collaborators. So I feel, you know, Glenn and I should find another project to do together. And we, you know, we have something coming up now. And Jack and I, and Harvey and I, and all the people I work with, Harvey Fierstein, you know, book writers and lyricists, I love them, and I, you know, it's kind of, I want to continue the relationship. So the way to continue the relationship is, rather than having dinner together, let's write a show.
Speaking of Glenn and Howard, congratulations on the paper mill, Little Mermaid.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, thanks. That's just, I think it's so great that Glenn, stepped in and,
oh,
that you head. That you and he managed to really augment that score so very well, and of course there've been changes since the Broadway.
Yes, we've some good changes since Broadway, and now it's ready for stock and amateur. And I was in Tokyo where we did this version of the show, and it was really good. I was like kind of blown away. You know, sometimes there is life after Broadway, as people know.
Yes, and Paper Mill has been obviously very, very good for you in recent years.
Yeah, it has.
As an incubator
for
Newsies. And yes.
Yes, you have. Brings up a good point, though. I remember Steve Sondheim in between 65 and 70 when he didn't have any shows on Broadway at all, but saying, "My day will come." And did you feel with Newsies, when it did not do well as a motion picture, that someday this property is going to be redeemed?
No. No, I thought that the material would be enjoyed because it's good songs. I didn't anticipate it having much of a life beyond it. And it was one of those surprises when I would, as my kids were growing up, seeing, you know, going to the camps or the school shows, and people say, "Oh, we're doing Newsies." I'm like, "Well, how are you doing Newsies?" You know, "Oh, well, we took dialogue from the movie and we took the songs and this went on a lot. Walking into a mall and I'm hearing, "What is it? Dum dum da da da," and they're like, doing Seize the Day, and it was a whole section of the mall was given over, and these kids were doing a big production of Seize the Day, and I go, "What the hell is going on here?" And they really embraced this thing. And you know, my mindset had been Newsies fell into the middle of that trio of big animated that I did, which were, you know, awarded and celebrated, Mermaid, Beauty, and Aladdin. And I just sort of took it as you know, well, that's the flip side. And then finally, when Disney said that we can't keep having this show being pirated, we've got to put out something. So that started the process. That ended up with it not being on Broadway. But every step of the way, I've been a cynic about it, to be honest.
All right, even to the point of which when Disney said, "We're going to bring it to Broadway for 100 performances," did you say, "Oh, no, we'll definitely pass 100?
Once we passed Paper Mill, then all bets were off. But I remember I was out in Seattle with Aladdin, and it was so exciting. We were out at the Fifth Avenue Theater, and it was a small production, but it was, you know, it was Casey Nicklau and Chad Beglin and this wonderful cast and this material that Howard and I had written. It was very exciting, and I knew we were going to start rehearsal for Newsies in August, and I thought to myself, "Oh God, poor Newsies." I'll go back and we'll open the Paper Mill and it'll, you know, people have such high hopes, but I actually was thinking, I don't know what's going to happen. But I got to say, first of all, the press was in this particular case, a very big part of the excitement of Newsies and the sense of arrival when it went to Paper Mill. It was taken very seriously and in a very surprisingly nice way, and then the audiences just were like, you know, just rabid. And it was, you know, I always say you write it and you put it out in the world and you take what comes, and I was not one that foresaw that, to be honest.
Well, it really is interesting to look at the arc of your career. I mean, when you think about it, you were not represented on Broadway until 1994, when Beauty and the Beast opened there. And by then, you had already been very well established with one of the longest-running off-Broadway shows in history.
Right.
And also all of your film work. I don't know if you're the first person who's ever had that arc of a career, but it really is interesting that
it is interesting. First of all, it's, you know, remember with Little Shop, we actively resisted bringing the show to Broadway.
Mm.
The Schuberts wanted us to bring it to Broadway, and Howard actively resisted it.
How early? From the beginning, Alan?
Oh, absolutely. It's a show that we had done, you know, God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater before Little Shop, and it was a 14-character musical, and it had a definitely a folky counterculture sensibility that came from Kurt Vonnegut, of course, but that show was intended to move to Broadway. Well, it happened to be, first of all, it was a season of Evita and Sweeney Todd, and they couldn't raise the money to bring it to Broadway. It was a big disappointment, and we couldn't run off Broadway because the show was too big, for an off-Broadway house, and we were at that weird situation at it was called the Intermedia Theater, which is, mm-hmm. before that had been the Eden, and where we had roped off, you know, probably two-thirds of the theater, and it was this little center section where it was just, you know, so the show kind of died off-Broadway. So we said, well, with Little Shop, let's write a show that is intended for off-Broadway. And it was 9 characters, and it was, you know, meant to be in a funky, out-of-the-way space, and we kept it that way. And then basically, after that, I worked on a show, 2 shows that were intended for Broadway, but couldn't make it there. One was The Apprenticeship of Betty Kravitz, which even now is still trying to find its way. And it was a wonderful show, but it's about it's a difficult character. It's not a very savory central character. And Kix, the showgirl musical, which I wrote with Tom Ion, and we did workshop after workshop of that. And also, I think the AIDS crisis got in the way of those shows coming to Broadway because, Tom was sick. And so I just was then out doing films. And in between was also A Christmas Carol. And A Christmas Carol was basically totally a Broadway show experience. It was Mike Awkward and Susan Stroman and Lynn Ahrens and me and Tony Walton and Paul Gemignani, musical director. And it was in every sense a Broadway show, but it was, you know, 10 blocks downtown.
Good point.
At the Garden.
Tell me about your plans for, we read in the New York Times that Hunchback is on track and that, of course, Aladdin's already been announced. And, you know, you seem to be the master of being able to keep 5 shows in the air at a time. So how do you schedule your days out? And are you traveling all around to meet with different creative teams? Are they coming into you?
Stephen Schwartz and I actually live close by each other, just played tennis yesterday, and said, okay, we got to get together week after next. Let's, you know, have a little more work to do on Hunchback. And it's just part of our, you know, it's like a doctor goes to the office, you know. Let's play tennis at 2 because we're doing our writing from, you know, in our studios from 11 to 1 or whatever.
Who won?
Well, it was doubles.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I see.
and we split the sets, actually. Okay, we were on different sides.
All right.
Very diplomatic.
But singles, Stephen almost always beats me. He's very good.
I see a new Broadway Cares fundraiser here.
Oh, my God.
That terrifies me. You know? Performing is one thing, but watching me play tennis, no. You know, but I'm traveling a lot because also what's going on is a lot of these shows are happening all over the world now.
That's what I was thinking.
With stage entertainment and also the normal relationships that Disney has and stage entertainment has, Mermaid and Beauty and Sister Act and Newsies and Aladdin and all these shows are opening, all over the place. And you know, it's always good when I go and show up. So like tonight, I'm flying over to Paris, and seeing the opening of Beauty and the Beast at the Mogador Theater in Paris. And that's an emerging market because in France there had not been a lot of long run musicals. Sister Act just finished running for a year in Paris, and I love those. You know, it's one of the perks of the career is, you know, when the kids grow up and they have their own lives and you get to visit, you know, it's kind of like visiting the grandchildren. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of that.
Ellen, are those shows being done in translation?
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, translators are a huge part of got part of the industry. It's been in Moscow twice now, with Mermaid and before Mermaid. Oh, Beauty, and then Mermaid. Anyways, but it's all that stuff is great, and that's where most of the travel comes. Other than that, I have my studio here, and Harvey Fierstein lives 5 minutes away, and Stephen Schwartz is 8 minutes away, and my collaborators come up by train, and we just hole up in my studio and work and have a great time. It's, thank God, it's still fun.
Well, we have all sorts of back to that theme of the Broadway Cares benefits in Manhattan and Fire Islands, but we have nothing up in Westchester, so maybe we can get that whole Westchester community rally up there.
Absolutely.
So, Will, we will let you run on your way for the day. I'm sure you have a busy day, and you're off to Paris tomorrow. Tonight or tomorrow?
Tonight. As soon as I get off, I'm going to start packing.
All righty. Well,
good to talk to you guys.
Thanks.
Have a great day, and talk to you soon.
Have a great one.
Okay, bye.
Thank you, Alan. Bye-bye. That was such a treat for us to have Alan join us before he's off on his trip. He's literally packing now. So that was very nice. So Peter just came back on a plane where you were out in Nebraska, was it, Peter, at the International Thespian Festival?
Yeah, in Lincoln on the campus of the University of Nebraska. It was really an amazing experience because about 4,000 kids attended this conference and festival where kids brought their shows to be seen. Some of them were cuttings. I actually saw Legally Blonde both in a cutting and Soup to Nuts, the entire show. So they didn't have to be musicals. The Elephant Man was done too. And it was so impressive to see kids pay attention so vividly to shows. Specifically, in Elephant Man, when he said the line about, "I believe my head's so big because it's so full of dreams," to hear 2,000 kids, that's what this theater could hold, go, oh, they were hearing this perception for the first time, and they were so moved by it. But, this was in the middle of a show where it could be very easy for lines to get lost, and these kids were truly paying attention. It's wonderful to see them all with their T-shirts heralding this Broadway show or another, and everybody getting along and everybody being impressed by everybody else's show, which was certainly worthwhile, each one. A couple of things that I have to say. The Color Purple was done. It was brought there by the Northwest School of the Arts from Charlotte, North Carolina. And what was impressive here is that I later learned that some of these kids were virtually homeless. And one of them actually had a father who was in prison. And I mean, the point is, these kids could easily be on the wrong path. And theater has saved them without a question of a doubt. That here they are being able to travel to a new place and have us all go crazy for how astonishing these kids were. Being in these parts that, of course, are usually played by adults. But the girl who played Celie was so amazing in the way that she aged so well. The boy who played Mister was amazing, too, in the way that he changed from this terrible human being to this more sensitive guy. It was so impressive to see him, most of the performance, be such a terrible human being. And then when he came out for his curtain call and he heard that swell of applause that happened because people really appreciated him, he actually started crying. And it was so tender to see this happen, to see this kid who, for virtually the entire night, had been, you should pardon the expression, a bastard. And here he was being so sensitive. So a lot of magic goes on here, and it's beautifully organized. I didn't hear of any chaos, people being in the wrong place, the wrong time, anything like that. Wonderfully organized. So my hat's off to the people who do this, but my hat's also off to the directors who once again prove that there are so many creative directors in high school theater who I really and truly believe could have had professional careers if indeed they had opted to do so, or frankly, if they'd been at the right place at the right time. Quorum Boy, remember Quorum Boy?
Yeah. Sure.
On Broadway? Imagine teenagers doing that show. They were flying in, seriously, on wires. I mean, all this kind of business. Quorum Boy is the most astonishing show I have ever seen teenagers do. Now, just from the vantage point, think of it this way. The show is 2 hours and 40 minutes long. So, I mean, even that, you know, the fact is that you have to rehearse more. You know, you have to get 40 minutes more material right. But this was actually even more impressive because it wasn't just one school. This was a Texas All-State production. Louis Munoz, who's a director, gets kids from all over the state and has them come and perform. So you got the best of Texas here. And, you know, don't forget, this is a show that's British, and I didn't hear a trace of a Southern accent at all. When I started seeing the show, I didn't even look to see what high school was doing it, and to find out later that these kids natively had Southern accents, and I heard them later talking, because of course they were wearing t-shirts that said Corum Boy, and in the hotel I would overhear them, and they were drawling, you know, all that kind of business, but not when they were on stage. It really is. I would estimate I've seen somewhere between 300 and 500 high school shows in my life, I would guess. I mean, this was easily the finest one I have ever seen. So, under the circumstances, if you are a high school teacher or a student, you know, make sure that you get involved with this Thespian Festival next year. If you're a teacher, find out about it. If you're a student, tell your teacher that he must get involved, because this is really quite amazing. But what's so great is the camaraderie, to see so many kids learning from each other, being impressed with each other. And, you know, there's nothing like a high school audience, because I was thinking of this. This is analogous to a kitten with a string. You know, you throw a string at a kitten and the kitten goes crazy. And, you know, a few years later, you go to that same cat and throw the piece of string, and the cat looks at you and say, what do you think? You know, you think I'm going to respond to that? Well, my point is that kids are the best audiences. Yeah, things that don't impress us very much at all, we jaded adult audiences. But even the slightest flare when somebody walks off gets a titanic round of applause. It's fun to see kids react that way. And that certainly was true of the musical 13. I mean, really, what a great place to do 13. Huh? You know, I mean, granted, all these kids are older than 13, but 13 wasn't so long ago that they don't remember 13. It was funny actually seeing a musical where the kids performing it were too long in the tooth for their roles, you know, because they weren't 13. You know, they were 16, 17, 18, whatever they are. Yeah, and yet, you know, they certainly remembered 4 or 5 years ago when they were 13 and the problems they had. And of course, some of the problems in 13 are problems they still have. So, but wonderfully done. No slip-ups, no wigs falling off, no scenery falling over, nobody going, forgetting lines. No, slick as can be. And really, I saw 10 shows and had the time of my life.
Well, this was sponsored by the Educational Theater Association, which their tagline is Shaping Lives Through Theater Education, which is just awesome to see.
Yeah.
And you can find their website at schooltheater.org. And we'll have a link to it in the show notes. So if you go to Broadway Radio, you can find it very easily there. And I'm noticing here again, we're not shilling, but the diamond sponsor is MTI. So MTI is sponsoring this, is one of the big sponsors of this festival. And some of the other sponsors are AADA, the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, Broadway Cares, Disney Theatricals, New York Conservatory for Dramatic Arts, New York Film Academy, Playbill, Rodgers and Hammerstein Theatricals, Sam French, and Theatrical Rights Worldwide. So certainly lots of New York organizations making this trek out to Nebraska for our future, the development of what's going to be happening and coming up through the ranks.
Speaking of making the trek out, so did Hunter Bell and Jeff Bowen, because the title of show was done there. And I sat behind them. We had assigned seats. I mean, it wasn't like I purposely did this. They were in J, I was in K. And it was so endearing to see them react to teenagers playing, literally, of course, Hunter and Jeff. I mean, you know the show. And as a result, to see them represented up there by kids, you know, and also, has title of show ever played to more people? I mean, you know, 2,000 people in the house, you know, so, and
look at that.
And the kids getting most of the inside jokes. All right. You know, when they heard about Wonderful Town being written in 3 weeks, there was no laughter of recognition. I'll grant you that. But certainly the more recent shows they responded to, and they got the inside jokes. And that's what was so wonderful, again, that these kids really felt, here's where I belong, which is probably, yeah, it is a show mentioned in the title of the show, now that I think of it. Here's where I belong. And that's what was great, to see everybody in peaceful coexistence and just enjoying themselves.
Well, again, this is something that I hope that we're going to talk about further during, as the summer progresses. We plan to have some educators come on and chat with us about theater education. But also coming up this week is the National High School Theater Music National High School Music Theater Awards, the Jimmys. Is that tomorrow night?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So yeah. So I suppose we'll chat about it again later on in the in shows in the future, if not next week.
I'm really looking forward to it, as I do every year. It'll be interesting to go this year, especially because now I think the event is so much more high profile after the PBS documentary of last year's event. And but it's always just so thrilling. And the hosts this year are Laura Osnes and Santino Fontana. So they're going to be the star power, but it's really all about the kids and these amazingly talented kids.
Laura Osnes and Santino Fontana, can't they get anybody good looking?
I mean, God love these two people for doing all these events. You know, I mean, every time you turn around, they're doing an event and they're doing some good for the Broadway community. My hat's off to them. I think it's terrific. And Santino Fontana, I'm told, was terrific recently, and she loves me out at Caramore. So he had time to fit that in. But I heard nothing but the best things about him and, for that matter, that production as well.
All right. So that encompassed most, if not all, of Peter's week, because you were out there for quite a few days.
That was it.
All right, so let's move forward. Michael got to see Unlocked at the Duke on 42nd Street, which is a Prospect Theater Company production. So tell us about that, Michael.
Yes, it was apparently done a few years ago as part of Nymph. It's book and lyrics by Sam Karner, music by Derek Greger. Peter Felicia, you had asked earlier if it was Peter Mills' show. I guess it's his show in the sense that he's the... he's involved with the Prospect Theater Company, but as associate artist, but he is not involved with this particular show. Directed and choreographed by Marlo Hunter, and it's now at the Duke on 42nd Street, which I haven't been to that often. It really is quite a good space for the right kind of show. And this was this show. I pretty much adored it, and I think it was largely because I really knew nothing about it. I did not see the Nymph production, but I'm really glad I saw this one. It's a very fanciful tale set. I think it doesn't exactly specify. I think it's supposed to be in the late 1700s, early 1800s, in and around Hampton Court in England, and it sort of put me in mind of Triumph of Love in the tone of it, and the general time setting. But I really loved it. I thought the score was superb. It was one of those scores where that kind of really manages to create a feeling of the time period and yet sound very modern at the same time. And that is not easy to do. So my hat's off to the composer, Derek Greger, for that. And the lyrics by Sam Karner, just extremely clever and witty and lovely. The story in a nutshell is there are these two brothers, Roderick and Edwin, played respectively by Sidney James Harcourt and A.J. Shively, who are pursuing these two sisters, Clarissa, played by Jennifer Blood, and Belinda, played by Gillian Gottlieb. But let's just say that they don't necessarily end up with who they wanted at the beginning of the show. And it's just very delightful and very well done. And it's, as I mentioned before, it's a very fanciful show. There are sylphs in it, Ariella, Esther, and Avia, played by Chandler Reeves, Maria Couch, and Catherine Lefrere. And there are also three gnomes, Umbriel, Caleb, and Barney, played by Chris Gunn, Adam Daveline, and Hansel Tan. So they fit into the plot as well. I mean, I don't think it's a perfect musical. I thought it maybe could use a little more tightening, and I understand that they've been continuing to work on it. So, you know, bravo to them for that. But I just totally, totally loved it. I really urge everyone to get to see it if you can. It's it's not an expensive ticket aside from everything else. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6-piece orchestra, conductor, piano, guitar, bass, violin, cello, percussion. So beautifully orchestrated that, you know, you didn't feel like you were missing anything. And A.J. Shively, I suppose, is probably one of the best known people in the cast from La Cage aux Folles, the recent revival, and several other things. Also, Jennifer Blood has done a few things that people might know. Remember the name Sidney James Harcourt, because he was just so charming as a character that called to mind maybe one of the princes in Into the Woods, except not that stupid. You know, just kind of a stuffy in a way guy, but really also very sweet and charming, and you just were rooting for him all evening, and I think he's got a tremendous amount of leading man potential. So, and Jillian Gottlieb, who I'm not really that familiar with, but she very much in a Kristen Chenoweth prototype kind of role as Belinda, with some really amazing coloratura high notes right at the beginning of the show, as I recall. I think, I swear to God, she hit a note. I think it might have been a high E. Mm-hmm. But if it wasn't, it was close. You know, I guess one of the reasons that I loved it so much is you really don't see anything like this very often at all. Generally similar to Triumph of Love. If you like that and that kind of sensibility, I think that you really might like this very much as well. So check it out.
All right. So it is playing, I think, here through July 13th. So you have some opportunity to see it in the next 2 weeks. And it's at the Duke, as we mentioned, on 42nd Street. So we see that Zach Braff has joined the cast of Bullets Over Broadway. And it's an interesting choice. So Zach Braff making his Broadway debut, isn't it?
I don't know if I'm doing anything else. But
yeah, I believe so. I saw him in a benefit. I think maybe it was a public theater benefit. But yes, absolutely.
I love this movie. I think it's a terrific picture. And, of course, it's my favorite Woody Allen movie. And a lot of people say, well, yeah, of course it would, because it deals with Broadway. It's not that. I just love the theme about the fact that an artist is truly willing to kill for his art, because that's what happens in this picture. Yes, we have a playwright who wants to direct, and he really believes that everything he's done so far in his life has been ruined because he hasn't had the chance to direct his own work, and he's the only one who can do it justice. However, he compromises from the outset. He immediately agrees when a gangster is willing to put up all the money, even though it means that the gangster's girlfriend will have to be in the show and she can barely speak English, let alone act. She's truly terrible, and he will never fire her because, of course, if he does, then the whole production falls apart, and he will take this production at any cost, which proves that he's not a real artist because he's willing to compromise. Well, in the meantime, the girlfriend has a bodyguard who may be a thug, who may be inured to killing people, but nevertheless, he happens to have a wonderful mind where it comes to writing, and he starts making suggestions, which even the cast feels are good suggestions, and little by little, the playwright starts taking his suggestions, and virtually the play becomes The Thugs. And what's so amazing, of course, is that the thug decides that he is not going to endure having this terrible actress, this girlfriend in the cast, and kills her. So he's willing to die for his art, and does, in fact. So this is a marvelous property with a terrific theme. And while I wish that Marvin Hamlisch had done the score is that was rumored for some time. And I'm sorry to hear that we're just going to get famous songs in the show, making it a glorified jukebox musical. I still have great hopes for Bullets Over Broadway because I love the original property so much.
Yes, I was reminded that that it was supposed to be Marvin Hamlisch that was discussed. And I, if I understand correctly, it was he and Craig Carnelia. Is that right?
I don't remember that. I'm not saying no.
And I think that I've heard that they may actually have written some of it. So who knows?
Maybe they did. Yeah.
Maybe that will turn up someday. But yes, the film is set in 1928. We are hearing that this will have period songs. And that will be interesting, I guess, in the sense that, I mean, yes, I absolutely agree.
It'll be good songs.
well, and also maybe from an era that we know especially hear that often. I mean, I think from the 30s on, we've heard a lot of songs, you know, from various eras in various jukebox musicals on Broadway, but maybe not from the 20s and previously.
Well, it all depends. I mean, if they really come up with songs that we're not familiar with and we haven't heard a million times, fine. I mean, there may be some old Cole Porter things that we don't know, though it does seem that so much of his work has been mined tremendously. You know, it would be great, but the thing is, for me, when I'm seeing a book musical and suddenly an old song comes in, I can't wait till they're finished so they can get to the next part of the story, because I've heard the song. I understand. I know what's going to happen. And so many times, of course, the song doesn't quite fit the moment and it's shoehorned in. So that's the problem. Of course, we are talking about Susan Stroman here, who's a very smart lady. You know, so as a result, we are going to find that she is going to rise to the occasion in many instances here. I know she will. That said, though, I prefer an original score.
Well, it will be really interesting to see. Do you suppose, have they made any statement? Are the songs going to be used in the sense of trying to fit into the plot, you know, being sung by characters to each other?
I know what you're talking about.
Or are they all going to be, or maybe some of them will be used as performance numbers?
Obviously, we are going to see at least one number being a performance number, because Thug's girlfriend, the Tootsie, is indeed appearing in some sort of show, not unlike Adelaide's Hotbox review. It's something like that. We will see that number, and fine, you know, we'll accept that. But that's really the only number of that kind that's in the show. So the rest of it has to be book stuff. I'm also excited too to hear that Betsy Wolff is going to be in it. I'm a big fan of her. She was so good recently in the last 5 years, and she's going to play the playwright's girlfriend. So and I'm sure she'll be wonderful.
Yes, and it's Brooks. Really quite a cast. Yeah, Brooks Ashmanskas. And Vincent Pastore, many people know from The Sopranos, among other things. He's really fantastic. I've seen him on stage a few times, and he's really great on stage. I think that it might be his Broadway debut, too, though.
I would think
that,
so.
Right?
Yeah.
But I've seen him off Broadway. And Helene York, I don't think I'm familiar with her. She's playing Olive. So that, and Lenny Wolpe, I'm told it's pronounced Lenny Wolpe, as Julian Marx. Costumes, William Ivy Long, lighting, Donald Holder, scenic design, Santo Loquasto. I mean, this is the A, you know, the A plus list. So, you know, let's hope for the best.
Yeah, now. Absolutely. Also in the news this week, Rupert Holmes is adapting John Grisham's The Time to Kill. It's going to open in October at the Golden.
Yeah, how interesting.
Yeah. So I love that. I love that it's going.
It's nice. I mean, I know the play got a mixed reception when it was down in Washington, but Rupert is one of our definite heroes. I mean, I adore Peter Stone, and his book for 1776 has never been surpassed. I read the original Curtains, and I read what Rupert Holmes did with it, and he is truly a savior of monumental proportions. So my point is, even though the play did not turn out to be a sensation down in Washington, the fact remains, this guy knows what to do. So as a result, and isn't it wonderful that somebody as popular as John Grisham would have an interest in the Broadway theater and allows this to happen? So we're all looking forward to this one.
Playbill's article on this notes that courtroom dramas used to be a regular staple on Broadway, or no longer, and they noted that the last one was A Few Good Men, which is interesting because Ken Davenport's working on bringing A Few Good Men back to Broadway, which is Sorkin's play as well.
Really?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, there has been talk of that. Here I go blowing my own horn, but nevertheless, this week I sold another book, and it deals with the 1963-64 season, and I'm going to compare it, of course, to the 2013-2014 season, because it's been 50 years. And one of the things I notice is that A Case of Libel was a courtroom drama that ran for the entire season and dealt with the Westbrook Pegler scandal. Now, many people don't even know what I'm talking about, because this is something that happened so long ago, but it was a big scandal at the time. And the idea of a courtroom trial being based on the book that Louis Neiser wrote about the famous attorney, that could run for an entire season in a season that was so remarkable anyway. A season that included Burt Lahr and Carol Channing and Barbara Streisand and Carol Burnett and Steve Lawrence and Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward and Robert Preston. Look how long it took me to get to Mary Martin and Richard Burton and Alec Guinness. I mean, really, quite a season. So as a result, you know, that book is happening, and I will be dealing with the fact that there used to be courtroom dramas that used to show up regularly. And yes, this is an anomaly now.
This must be the week of these type of opening announcements, because A Night with Janis Joplin also announced they're going to open October 10th. I guess filling up the fall season right away. So you guys know what at least you guys will be doing in the fall very quickly.
Yes, indeed.
One thing we didn't mention about Bullets Over Broadway is that it will be at the St. James, which answers that question, because a lot of people were saying, what's going to be at the St. James, which has for years and years been considered one of the prime Broadway houses. So now we know.
Yeah. Did we mention Grisham's going to be at the Golden? I think I did. And Janis Joplin's going to be at the Elysium. So those properties are no longer available to you, sir.
I was at the Lyceum the other night. I got to re-see The Nance because someone invited me. And I enjoyed the show very much again. But also, what a beautiful theater.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure of the – I seem to remember that it was restored to some degree when they made the film of Ragtime.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And they used it I've never seen the film of Ragtime, but apparently it's in that. I assume maybe it's for used for where Evelyn Nesbit performs. But anyway, that's what I've been told. But I think since then, because that was quite some time ago, it has been further restored and renovated, and it's absolutely beautiful.
So on the other side of that equation is that we had an off-Broadway musical that we thought was going to do pretty well. Murder Ballad announced that they're closing. So
I loved it. I had not seen it in that small space at MTC, the off-Broadway space. I loved it at the Union Square Theater. But having said that, I was a little surprised it moved, just for various reasons. I mean, no really big star in it, and et cetera, et cetera. And I assumed that it had really, really good demand and word of mouth in the previous run. But there again, it's always hard to tell when you're doing a very limited run in a very small theater. I guess it's hard to tell what the prospects are going to be for a commercial production. I think they very much tried to make it an event kind of thing, as we've discussed recently, in terms of the environmental staging and people sitting, much of the audience sitting on the stage, basically, at tables, while the action happens all around them. And I thought it was terrific, but...
I guess they're out of money. It's that simple, and that's too bad, because if so, that's not such great producing, because they should have had enough of a reserve to keep it going, because this definitely could find an audience, just from the vantage points that it is so distinctively different that you can't go anywhere else in New York and see a staging like this. And and the club atmosphere is fun for a lot of people, and you know, getting the drinks beforehand and sitting at tables, a lot of people like that type of thing.
Right.
I think it just has to be marketed correctly, and somehow this is one of those shows, and we've had a few of them over the years, that just give up so quickly. I thought Bear gave up much too quickly too, and give up so quickly after getting enough encouragement from audiences and critics that it doesn't warrant this quickly a closing.
That's a very good point, Peter. You know, it's you know, I guess it's hard to be a producer.
Sure. Sure.
If it was easy, everybody would do it.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
But I'm sorry it's closing. I have to get a hold of the album because I really liked it. And I imagine one reason they're choosing this particular time to close is I know that Will Swenson was going to leave anyway, because I know that Jim Newman was going to take over for him. So I guess they figured that the ticket sales, the advanced ticket sales, didn't warrant, you know, going through a change of cast. But that's unfortunate.
So scheduled closings that are coming up right now. Folks, Hollywood stars that are going to go leave Broadway for the Hamptons, I guess. We have Anne closing. We have I'll Eat You Last closing. We have Tom Hanks' show, Lucky Guy, closing. So that's all coming up this week. And then on Thursday, if you are not so otherwise engaged, please turn on PBS and see the 237th birthday of America's Capitol Fourth. And I guess on there, they're going to have a cast of Motown is going to be on it. Barry Manilow is going to be on it. Megan Hilty, Darren Criss. So lots of Broadway connections there. And you can have some fun catching up and watching great performances on PBS as well. So what's coming up for you guys on the 4th? Are you doing anything fun this week?
I am toying with the idea of driving down to Gettysburg to see the Civil War, because that's a good place for it. And it would seem to be very moving. Whether or not I'm going to drive the 213 miles.
Frank Wildthorne's Civil War?
Yes, indeed.
Or the actual Civil War.
Yeah.
No, I'm not seeing the actual Civil War.
Well, you said Gettysburg.
The North one. Anyway, I know how it ends.
For us, why don't you? Spoiler.
Spoiler alert, right, yeah. So, anyway, the fact remains that I always like to see things in places where they really have extra meaning. And certainly, the Civil War musical would have extra meaning in Gettysburg. So I'm toying with the idea. I haven't made any specific plans yet. But I'm seeing the Tom Durgan play, too, on Tuesday. So, not much else going on.
Speaking of location-specific stuff, I don't recall. Did they ever do Phantom at the Paris Opera House?
No, but I bet the day comes when they do.
Oh, I don't know if that's possible just because of the setup. But that's very interesting. And that brings up my question that I think I may have asked on the podcast before, that the film of the musical of Phantom of the Opera does not take place in that opera house. And I always wondered if that was for legal reasons. I mean, it's famously the Palais Garnier, the famous old, you know, old, incredibly ornate Paris opera house. But in the movie of the musical, it's not. They call it something else. And it's obviously not that building because they show like mock-ups of it. Mm-hmm. So I never
thought about that. Get Patrick Wilson on the phone.
I have to figure out who would know the answer to that, but it's probably difficult to figure that out. Anyway. I just came back from seeing South Pacific at the Engelmann Theater in Northport Long Island.
Oh, that's right, yes.
Which Northport, I think, maybe is famous among musical theater fans as Patti LuPone's hometown. But aside from that, it has this really wonderful theater, the John Engelman Theater, that does, you know, lots of, I mean, here's their 2012-2013 season. I Love You, You're Perfect Now, Change, Sweet Charity, A Christmas Carol, Wait Until Dark, Boeing Boeing, and South Pacific. So that's the kind of, you know, really eclectic fare that they do. And they did a wonderful production of South Pacific, directed by Igor Goldin, whom some of you may know as the director of Yank and a few other things. With Glee, he directed. I really loved that show a lot. The interesting about this production, well, first of all, it looked very much, very, very much like just a downsized version of the Lincoln Center production. And in terms of the sets and the general physical look of it, the biggest negative I would say was that they had a very small orchestra. And, you know, for South Pacific, it's really a small theater. Yeah.
It's hard. You know, I saw Hairspray there. I saw an excellent production of Hairspray there.
Yeah.
They have a space problem. You know, when you put a big musical up there, they don't have space for the orchestra. I'd imagine that smaller musicals, if they ever did like Last 5 Years or something, would be it'd be a great venue for that. I've seen some very good things there. They do children's theater as well. They do Broadway concerts, and they job in a lot of Broadway talent because it's so close. And I don't know if you're aware, sort of connection between the Engelman Theater and Theater Mania, and the owners of, I think it's the owners of Theater Mania own Engelman Theater. It's not, the corporations aren't related. They're separate corporations, but the owner of Theater Mania owns the Engelman Theater and has put money into it. And John Engelman he's somebody who served America in the armed forces and died about 10 years or so ago. I think he died in Afghanistan. I'm not positive about that. And the theater was memorialized for him. And he was from Northport as well.
Yes, they have a whole page dedicated to him in the playbill. It's very nice. And the only previous show that I saw at the Engelman was a really excellent production of Damn Yankees with Andre DeShields as the best Applegate I've ever seen.
Ah, how nice.
This one does not have, I would say, any familiar names that you would know, but Kim Carson, really excellent job as Nellie. And Rob Gallagher, some people might know. He's done several things in the city. And it says he played Emil on Broadway. So I imagine he must have been an understudy. In the Lincoln Center one, yeah, he has done a lot, but they were both. It was so interesting to me. I would not say that either of them gave the definitive performance of Nellie or Emil, but I love it when you see a show that you've seen many, many times, and someone will say a line in a way that you've never heard someone say it before, and it suddenly seems to you that it works. Mm-hmm. Better than you've ever heard it. Mm-hmm. I just really love that, and you know, it's obviously a tribute to the material, you know, the work of Oscar Hammerstein and Joshua Logan and, you know, and Richard Rodgers. So that happened a few times during this, and how interesting! I never thought of saying that line that way, you know, but it just seems so natural, and it just really works. We had the Bloody Mary was really. Excellent woman, Amy Jo Phillips. And Peter Carrier was Cable. I have to single him out because he was the best Cable I've ever seen. I guess that's a difficult role because of his transition during the show. And also he has to be, you know, basically this very, very upright model, you know, American boy, Marine type who then... We see him, you know, come into touch with his romantic and sexual side during the show. And that's not easy to do. And also, Younger Than Springtime is an incredibly beautiful song that is not of the type that you would ever hear written today. And, you know, maybe not the type that you would necessarily picture that kind of a character singing. But that's the whole point, is his transition. And really, Peter Carrier just was terrific. I think that the folks who played Cable in the Bartlett Sher version were really hampered by a very odd, very, very odd conception of that character on the part of the director, and that wasn't the case here. So, so that alone made the whole show just work so much better than. Actually, yes. I mean, in a sense, in that sense, worked better than the Lincoln Center production. So I highly recommend it, South Pacific. And keep your eye on the Angerman Theater for future things, because it was really the two things I've seen were great. Oh, one negative thing I have to say, if I were going to open a school, a theater school, one of the major courses would be in how to sing without back phrasing.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
It's getting to the point where it's driving me crazy in some shows. I think people think that it's more dramatic if they do that, or they're acting the song more. I think we've had this discussion. Sure. It was so bad in Follies that it really almost drove me out of my mind.
You were losing your mind.
Yeah. and I think I noted that they seem to have made a point of kind of clearing it up largely for the cast album of Follies. I'm talking about the recent revival.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you can hear vestiges of it there. Ron Raines in particular was just, it was really, 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 really too much. And I don't think that theater songs in general are meant to be backphrased. They're not conceived that way. They're not intended to be written that way in 99% of the cases. So that is the one thing I would say about the negative about this show, plus the orchestra size, which is probably unavoidable. And I wish people would pay attention to that. I wish musical directors and performers would really think about not doing that, because I really don't think it's a good idea at all.
You know, I see. I think of backphrasing as being. Responsibility of the musical director and the director to stop it.
Yes.
If it is happening. But I see it more and more often, and I see it in performers that don't do it in other things. So I sort of feel like they've been asked to do it at times, but certainly it's not the whole case.
I wonder if it happens sometimes more if people are doing a run of a show. I wonder if it happens more as the run continues, because people are trying, the actors are trying to make the songs more interesting and more in the moment for themselves. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. also maybe they just get a little more sloppy. So I think it's a combination of things, but I really just wish people would pay attention to it.
So one last thing about the Angerman Theater is that Northport, the town, is such a beautiful little town, and it's got great places to eat dinner. So
yes.
it's a nice place to have an evening away from New York City if you're in Manhattan. It's not really greatly accessible by Long Island Railroad. Long Island Railroad does stop in Northport, but the theater is a ways away from the Long Island Railroad, so it would be a Zipcar rental probably is the best way to go, or a car.
No, I went with a friend, and we took the train to Northport, which is about an hour and 15 minutes, I believe. And then you just get a cab.
It was easy enough to do that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
There were cabs there.
Absolutely. Northport's a beautiful little town, great places to eat, not overly expensive, especially if you're coming in from Manhattan, and grab some ice cream after. All right. So I guess that's about it for right now. So let's wrap up here. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you don't want to listen to us in iTunes, you can listen to us through the Stitcher app, which is an app for your BlackBerry, your Android device, your iPhone. your iPod Touch, and it'll be automatically streamed to you. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And if you go to BroadwayRadio.com, you can see all the show notes for some of the things we've talked about today, plus a link to the video from Alan Menken's song in Neighbors, and you could watch that that weird opening scene type of thing that we were talking about before. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Mama was poor. I'd meet a man and I'd follow him blindly. He'd snap his fingers. Me, I'd say sure. Suddenly Seymour is standing beside me. He don't give me orders. He don't condescend.
Forever, tell me the bad times are clean washed away.
Please understand that it's still strange and frightening. For losers like I've been, it's so hard to say.
Understand.